I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, the media is working overtime to normalize the Democratic Party's shift towards socialism. Plus, the National Education Association celebrating Washington State's new income tax. And as the U.S. plays in a critical World Cup match here in Seattle, has Balogun's red card turned political? That and much more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. That's Undivided. POD.com. Click on the banner that says support the show. Hello, hello, and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. I hope you all had a wonderful 4th of July celebrating our nation's 250th birthday. And now the work begins making sure that our country can last another 250 years. It is very critical that all of us are laser focused on identifying and calling out the media's efforts to try to normalize the Democratic Party's shift towards socialism. And this is going to happen in a lot of different ways. We're going to detail some of them here at the top of the show. There's a couple ways the media kind of decides what narratives it's going to push. And the media has the power here really to dictate the fate of our country, I think, and whether the Democratic Party truly turns into the party of socialism, and then that ultimately turns into communism. So one of it is the media's how it chooses to cover or not cover something. Because decisions to leave something out, decisions to not give something airtime, to not give something a headline, can make just as much of a difference as, you know, unfair coverage or preferential coverage to a certain political party. And how the media chooses to cover political violence on the extremes in this country, I think, is going to be a big factor in what happens moving forward over the next couple years, but 250 years. So we're going to discuss socialism and communism. And one of the hallmarks of communism that I want you to pay close attention to as we discuss is the vilification of dissent and the government control of dissent. And the reality that in communist societies, if people have disagreed with the government, dare to speak out against the government or the prevailing political views, their dissent is crushed in a couple ways. Their dissent can be crushed through re-education camps, which is something that has been used in every communist society that has ever existed. And their dissent can also be crushed via other means like death. They will literally kill people who disagree with them. I want you to ask yourself, what political movement in this country is closer to that reality? What political extreme in this country is closer to killing people who disagree with them politically? Is it the far right or the far left? Obviously, it's the far left. We've already had the far left in this country in recent memory kill someone who they disagreed with, Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk was assassinated because of his views on a variety of issues. It seemed most likely over transgenderism. But that is the hallmark of when a country is truly devolving into something like communism, which is not these one-offs of, you know, this person was a crazy person killed Charlie Kirk because of transgender ideology, but it's sort of this acceptance, a growing acceptance that it's okay to use violence against people who you disagree with. Now, there is a event coming up in Seattle called Make Heaven Crowded. That sounds nice, doesn't it? Make Heaven Crowded. And it's being put on by Pursuit Church. It's happening on July 24th. And the featured speaker for that event is Erica Kirk, the widow of the late Charlie Kirk of Turning Point USA. Now, I think normal people see that and they think, okay, you know, no big deal. Either you want to go, maybe it's something you're interested in, or you have no interest whatsoever in going because you're not religious or you didn't like Charlie Kirk or Turning Point USA and you just don't agree with it. That's what normal civilized people in a society do. But we're not living in a normal civilized society. So the far left has decided they are going to descend upon this event and they are going to protested, but I think we all know what happens when these particular individuals, when the indivisible types, when the Antifa types go out and seek to protest something they disagree with. I mean, you look at their flyer for this protest, and they've literally put devil horns on Erica Kirk. For what? For saying we want to make heaven crowded? So they've created a flyer, said, we're going to go protest her, like protest the widow of a man who was assassinated. Why? For what reason? And they're putting devil horns on her. Like she is evil. She is the enemy. She is dissenting. She is spreading a message, be it a political message or a religious message we disagree with. And so we must try to shut it down. And that's what the left does, the far left does, that the far right just does not do in America. And I do believe there's a far right in America, but it's certainly not as brazen. And something that they do not do is show up regularly, routinely, to events that they disagree with and either seek to have those events shut down or canceled by way of threats and intimidation, or to show up at events and physically hurt people. I mean, I think of Chloe Cole, the detransitioner who was supposed to speak at the University of Washington. And they had so many death threats toward Chloe Cole that they were able to shut down an event they disagreed with, words they disagreed with, through fear and intimidation. And I think had Chloe Cole shown up, they would have tried to kill her. You don't see this on the far right in America. You see it on the far left. And this is a population of people and a political movement that is starting to seep into the mainstream, because you don't see some sort of today widespread condemnation by the media in Seattle or by the left or our members of Congress saying, hey, leave Erica Kirk alone. You know, you don't have to show up and try to get the event shut down. That's just a weird thing. You don't see that. There's this acceptance that we are going to use threats and intimidation to silence voices we disagree with. And the left does that a lot. Now, I want you to compare some of this to, there was what I guess you could consider a far-right event that happened in D.C., the Patriot Front. You've probably seen the video.
We are people! Liberty! For the victory of the American spirit!
Victory!
Life! Liberty! Victory!
Life! Liberty! Victory!
Life! Liberty! Victory!
They took to chanting and marching. They had some American flags, some upside down American flags, some Confederate flags, basically chanting about reclaiming America. As far as I could tell, they all looked white. They all have their faces covered. I mean, but it's like a couple hundred white dudes in like JCPenney pants and polos with their faces covered, chanting about America. Now, I realize that there are a lot of people on the right, based on what came out about the Southern Poverty Law Center and them trying to fund, you know, far-right extremism to make it look like it's worse than it is, I realize there's a lot of people on the right who think that those are feds. I don't know if they're feds or not. I don't know if they're undercover Antifa or not. Let's just operate for a moment on the belief that these are really, you know, far-right Americans who, you know, are white supremacists. Let's just operate on that thing. Now, I think it's worthy of coverage. I think if you've got a group like this out marching by the hundreds in Washington, D.C. on the 4th of July weekend, I'm not saying the media shouldn't cover it, but how is the media covering it? Here's the Washington Post. Hundreds of uniformed members of what appeared to be Patriot Front, a white supremacist group, marched through D.C. and toward the Capitol. Their faces covered in white masks. The men carried flags, some upside down, others Confederate, as they chanted, "Reclaim America." And then there was this picture that was going around that was taken by Reuters, and it shows a black woman on the subway, and she's surrounded by these white Patriot Front members. And people were putting this image out there as like a defining image for America, like this very brave black woman who's sitting there around these white supremacists. And, you know, some news came out that she was like a homeless like person who had been like having an episode on the bus prior, but none of that matters. So let's just look at the picture for what it is. Black woman surrounded by all these white people. What are they not doing in that picture? You could think how you want about Patriot Front. I mean, if it truly is like a white supremacist organization, I'm obviously opposed to that. But what are they not doing in this picture? They're not yelling at her. They're not assaulting her. If you truly believe this is a white supremacist organization, right? No, she's just sitting there. They're sitting in their seats. They're holding on, getting to their destination where they're going to go march. What do you think would happen in this image if the situation was reversed? If this was some sort of Antifa or far left gathering, taking public transportation to go and march, and the person sitting there was, I don't know, a conservative in a MAGA hat. Do you think that image would have looked like that? Do you think that conservative in that MAGA hat would have gotten off that bus unscathed? Not a chance in the world. And that there is a difference. There is a big difference. Now, far left and far right, they're bad. But there is a reality that there's always going to be extremist opinions in public discourse that are protected by the First Amendment. So you have this group of a couple hundred white men. They decide to go to D.C. They dress up in weird, like I said, you know, JCPenney-looking outfits. No offense to JCPenney's. And they march around with their flags. They didn't break anything. They didn't hurt anybody. They espoused beliefs that are detestable. But that happens every single day on the left. And the left always takes it a step further towards vandalism, towards violence, towards threats, and towards intimidation. But then you look at that, that is a reality, that is a fact. But then look at how the media covers these things. So these were some of the headlines about the Patriot Front march in D.C. Dana Bash of CNN presses Doug Burgum as he deflects on Patriot Front march, so the media wants elected leaders to denounce it. Trump aide pressed to condemn white nationalist group. They want people in power on the right to denounce this sort of extremism. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm not saying they shouldn't be asking questions. Man surrounded by Patriot Front and viral photo has a message for America. Defining image of the era of American history. July 4th Patriot Front photo goes viral. So the media treated this with the utmost seriousness and urgency. White men marching in D.C., chanting things about taking back and reclaiming America. The media treated it with the utmost importance and urgency. They demanded answers from elected leaders. They condemned it. They condemned what it means at this juncture in American history. And in a bubble, I don't think that's a bad thing. In a vacuum, I don't think it's a bad thing to look at that and say, hey, this is really concerning. What is this movement? Where is it going? What do elected leaders have to say about it? But compare that to what we see when there is widespread, regular political violence like I have endured and like many other conservatives have endured, if you need a reminder. I think we have some video.
Fuck you, fascists! Fuck you, fascists! Fuck you, fascists! Fuck you,
fascists!
Racist!
Let him go, so he... No! Let him go!
Let him go!
Fucking there!
Give me my fucking hat, you fucking scumbag!
Give me my fucking hat. Leave me the fucking...
Give me
the fuck alone!
Leave me alone! Hey! You need to stop!
All of those are attacks by the far left on conservatives in America over the past year. Violent, brazen beatings. And when you go look at, and that's just a sampling, of course, and it's not just about independent journalists, attacks on ICE, attacks on police officers, vandalism, fires. Whenever there's something the far left doesn't agree with, their automatic response is a violent one. And if we had a functioning Fourth Estate, what would happen? Well, the Fourth Estate would treat it as just as serious, if not more serious, than the 200 or so white men who were marching in D.C. over the weekend. Because what screams more serious to you? Again, maybe 250 white men marching in D.C., not hurting anybody, saying some detestable things, but not hurting anyone, not breaking anything. Or weekly, violent, politically motivated assaults being carried out all over the country by far left factions. If we had a functioning Fourth Estate, those things would be treated with urgency. They'd be covered appropriately. But I was digging. I mean, I was digging, for instance, the Savannah Hernandez attack. I was like, how did the same media outlets who were just, you know, oh my gosh, breathless about the Patriot Front thing over the weekend, how did they cover the Savannah Hernandez attack? I'll be honest, a lot of them didn't. A lot of them never covered it. I found this one CBS News headline, Turning Point USA contributor and family accused of assaulting her share both sides of their story. Literally, Turning Point USA contributor, family accused of assaulting her share both sides of story. That's how CBS News covers it. And then just as an example, because I've seen this all over the place, the Antifa terror group that carried out the Prairie Land attack in Texas at the ICE facility where a local cop was shot in the neck. Well, the media's all, what is their concern? Oh, were the sentences too high? From The Guardian, activists accused of being part of Antifa get long prison terms in case seen as test of Trump's crackdown on dissent. The media, by media standards, the non-violent right wing is worse than the violent left wing. By media standards, run-of-the-mill conservatives are worse and more dangerous than literal avowed socialists. And so rather than cover this really dangerous shift towards socialism that's showing some communist tendencies, like violent crushing of dissent, what does the media do? Well, of course, they have to water it down. They know that the shift is dangerous, but it's a shift towards the left, not the right. So they have to water that down while they scream and shout about a group of 200 white men who were marching in D.C. that didn't hurt anybody. So this is from The Washington Post. Trump and Republicans returned to communist attacks against Democrats ahead of the midterm elections. President Donald Trump and fellow Republicans are reviving attacks on Democrats, labeling them communists. So rather than The Washington Post talking about the very real and concerning shift that Democrats are having towards socialism, they're making it about Republicans and how Republicans are framing it. It used to be that it was sort of universally accepted that socialism was bad. And whenever Republicans would call a Democrat a socialist, the media would say, well, they're not socialists. They're progressives, or they're Democrats, or they're Democratic socialists. But oh my gosh, Republicans are calling them socialists. But now that some Democrats are calling themselves socialists and embracing socialism, the media has to say, well, socialism isn't bad. Now that the Republicans are calling them communists. How dare the Republicans call them communists? They're not communists at all. And Trump has started to use the word communist.
You can be loyal to Karl Marx, or you can be loyal to America. You can be a communist, or you can be a patriot. You cannot be both. As for those who peddle Marxist lies about our heritage, tell our children that we live on stolen land, or that our heroes were oppressors, they're doing something much worse than slandering our past. They are slandering and attacking our future. Not going to let that happen.
So rather than, I don't know, take a look at, okay, are there some communist tendencies among these avowed socialists, and looking at what that means, what it'll look like when we see it, and just generally agreeing that communism has always been destructive and a deadly force that has left every society that has been subjected to it worse off, not better off. The media has to play cover for Democrats. The media has to play cover for the left. And the media always has to vilify Donald Trump. So now it's not about socialism on the left. It's about calling it communism when it's definitely not communism. So the Washington Post says President Donald Trump and his fellow Republicans are reviving a line of attack against Democrats heading into the midterm elections. They're communists. In just the past week, Trump has issued dark warnings that members of the Democratic Party's ascendant left are communists who want to completely destroy the traditional American way of life. The GOP's ideological focus conflates democratic socialism, which often centers on securing universal health care, higher taxes on the wealthy, and stricter corporate regulation, with communism, under which private ownership is largely eliminated. It has been building since Zohran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist, won the Democratic nomination for New York City mayor last year. So in the lead of this article, they're saying, well, look, these are socialists. They just want things like higher taxes on the wealthy and universal health care. They don't want to turn private ownership into public ownership, except, yes, they do.
If your landlord does not responsibly steward your home, city government will step in.
Step in. And remember, he went on to say, and they'll take it. They will take it and they will use it for their own purposes if you don't responsibly steward your private property. So it's right there in the words. Mamdani is a socialist, but some of his ideas are communist. And you have a movement on the left that regularly, routinely across America, in a way that has been escalating for the better part of 10 years, uses violence to silence political dissent, to silence and even kill people who have different ideas than them. These are all hallmarks of communism. And then you have the Fourth Estate that is doing everything it can to distract you from that, to have breathless headlines about a peaceful, albeit detestable, march in Washington, D.C., while saying nothing about far-left acts of violence, true violent extremism. And then they'll do articles about, oh, no, it's socialism, it's not communism. And you have members of the Democratic Party who are doing this as well. Congresswoman Susan DelBene of our state, we played this clip previously. She's supposed to be a moderate. She's welcoming socialists with open arms.
Are the Democratic socialists welcome in the Democratic tent?
Yeah, we're a big tent. I want to make sure that our big tent is a tent that is in the majority and that we have the gavels.
So the socialists are welcome?
Voters are choosing people across the country, and those are part of folks who are being elected, and they're going to come and join the caucus. But I got to tell you, we have just incredible candidates running, and our job is to make sure we have those gavels so we can actually do the work of the American people.
It is a coordinated normalization of socialism, which used to be something that these very Democrats would take issue with. If you were to call Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal a socialist back when she first ran for office, as an example, she would have said, I'm not a socialist, I'm a Democrat, I'm a progressive. But now she says, oh, actually, socialism is quite popular.
Reason that Donald Trump has to pivot from saying socialist to saying communist now is because socialism is actually quite popular. These ideas, whether you call it socialism or not, they are very popular across the country. So he's got to attach a new label to it. But I'm not concerned. We're all going to be here fighting for the things that that we are for and that we want to deliver for working people.
So when you just said socialism is very popular, can you name one socialist country that ended well?
There's plenty of examples of how these policies make a real difference, and I'm excited to make sure that Americans have the access to them.
So they just are moving the goalpost. So, it's socialism, but at least it's not communism. How long before they move the goalposts again? And when it starts to veer more closely into communism? Now all of a sudden communism is okay. This is how it works. This is how it has worked at every point in history, when you've had a deadly communist regime that has seized power. And the scariest part in America, where you have this robust free press that is supposed to be standing in the breach, is they are playing into it hook, line, and sinker, because they hate Donald Trump so much, they hate Republicans so much, that they're willing to watch our country go down a known path toward communism. The Seattle Times, when it put this article out, it was an article from the Washington Post, but they repackaged it for the Seattle Times. Same headline, but look at the picture they used. As socialism rises in popularity, GOP turns to new attack, communists. And they use a picture of Zohran Mamdani at Pride. And what is that telling the reader? That's telling the reader that, oh my gosh, it's an attack on gay people. It's an attack on trans people. And suddenly it becomes, again, about conservatives, not about socialism and communism and the danger of those things and the effect that it's having on especially young people in America who will be the future voters of America, who will decide what happens with our country in the next 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 250 years. The effect it's having on young people in America is profound. There was new polling out from Cato Institute where it had favorability ratings among Gen Z for socialism, capitalism, and communism. Socialism, 53% favoritism among Gen Z. And these are people born between like 1997 and 2012. So young people just getting ready to vote. Capitalism, 45% favoritism. More Gen Z voters, according to Cato, look favorably upon socialism than capitalism. And while they're all trying to distance themselves from communism, 38% of Gen Z voters have a favorable view of communism, which is obviously a failure in our education system, but it's also all the things that I just showed you. The media turning a blind eye to communism, turning a blind eye to socialism, watering it down, making it palatable. I mean, you can talk and we can have endless debates about the far right and the far left in America, but nobody, I would invite anyone to come on this show and explain to me why the far right is a greater threat to our American way of life. The side you should worry about always is the side that's using violence toward a political and ideological end. That side is the left right now. And look, if you get Patriot Front and Patriot Front starts to go out and they start to go to every event where someone's speaking that they disagree with and threaten them and intimidate them, if they're going out and they're burning buildings and they're lighting cop cars on fire, they're going to the homes of people they disagree with, they're sniping political leaders on the left and killing them, I will be the first one there. I will be the first one there to try to stand up to them, to call attention to what they're doing, but it's not happening right now. And I'm a whole hell of a lot more concerned about the regular acts of violence being perpetrated by the far left in America and their shift towards socialist and communist ideals, which have killed millions of people throughout history, than I am of some guys in some cargo pants marching around with Confederate flags in Washington, D.C. And so it's up to all of us to make sure that we're calling this out, that we're asking more of the press, and that whenever they do this, whenever they try to normalize socialism, communist ideas, whenever they choose not to cover acts of violence perpetrated by the left in favor of peaceful protests by the right, that you have to call them out, you have to draw attention to it, because without the press, we are so royally screwed. Without a functioning press that's going to call balls and strikes and talk about the dangers of these political ideologies, our country won't last another 250 years. And for the people who are going to protest Erica Kirk in a couple weeks, shame on you. What kind of disgusting people go to protest at a religious event? The widow of a man who was assassinated. You are disgusting, vile, awful human beings. All right, coming up next, the city of Seattle has a big day today, I would say. There's a major game. USA is playing in the World Cup, but there is one community that is going to be out protesting, saying that the World Cup has been a disaster for their businesses. We'll discuss. First, if you are thinking about, I don't know, leaving the state of Washington, reach out to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. Evan W. gives Wes 5 stars. He says this was a tough multifamily transaction with a buyer who was often unreasonable and difficult. Wes stayed professional, kept the deal together, and pushed it to the finish line when it could have easily blown up. That takes experience and grit. I appreciate the effort and look forward to the next deal. And yes, it's a difficult market right now. I mean, we have some friends who are trying to move to Arizona and they're having a really difficult time selling their house. And I was like, you guys got to reach out to Wes Jones because Wes has a strategy in this market environment. You know, you can get the same results, but you might just have to put a little more effort in. And a lot of it comes down to staging. Again, when I was talking to my friends, I looked at the staging for their home and the pictures. I was like, those look awful. I'm going to be honest with you. Like Wes's staging and the images and the marketing are just so fantastic. I think they went with a friend who wanted to help them sell their home. And it was like, well, loyalty to a friend. I was like, you can be loyal to your friend who got their real estate license like a year ago, or you can, I don't know, sell your home. Sellwithwest.com. Sellwithwest.com. It really just is a better way to sell your home. All right, a couple things I want to touch on just really quickly. So last week, I think it was, we talked about how members of the Chinatown International District, they went out and they were protesting the city of Seattle for failing to make sure the neighborhood was safe and welcoming for the World Cup. Here's a clip of that.
We trusted Mayor Wilson. We believe in Mayor Wilson, but in the end, she lied to our Asian American community.
Yeah, and he says that she lied because they promised that Chinatown ID would be cleaned up. It's, you know, neighborhood besides Soto that's closest to the stadiums, but instead they just pushed all the drug addicts and the homeless there.
She said there would be zero tolerance for drug dealing and selling stolen goods, but the corner of 12th Avenue and Jackson Street is worse than ever. Instead of coming up with a plan to drive World Cup football traffic to our way, she sent homeless drug addicts into our community so soccer fans would not have to see them in downtown, the waterfront, or High Place Market.
Yeah, and as we've been talking about, you know, the World Cup and that being awarded to Seattle was such an opportunity for businesses. And there are a lot of businesses in some areas of the city that have seen a tremendous amount of success from the success of the World Cup. And I think it's been great so far in Seattle. But mostly those are in downtown. Those are in Soto. And the city really did very little to make sure that the Chinatown International District got some love. So I know that some community groups are going to be out protesting the city of Seattle today as fans head to the stadium for the U.S. game. There was this video our friend Jonathan Cho found of a Chinatown business owner saying not only, you know, have they not seen the foot traffic that the city said they should expect to see from the World Cup, but he said it's some of the worst days of business he's ever had.
I think the World Cup games in Seattle caused my business to have the worst sales day that it's ever had. Hey, it's Vince. I run a Vietnamese American bake shop in Seattle where I share my shelves with other local Asian American bakers, and I don't normally make videos like this. The World Cup is happening in Seattle right now, and for months, the city, universities, every nonprofit under the sun has been urging us business owners to prep like crazy. They want us to staff up, overstock, and ramp up production because we're going to see crushing loads of visitors. And businesses located in the International District, which, hello, were particularly urged to prepare. We're only about a half a mile away from the stadiums. It's like a 10-minute walk. Now, I think I was already skeptical about this because I think there's very little overlap between sports tourism and culturally specific, culturally resident businesses. Bars? Absolutely. Fast casual American food like pizza and burgers? Slam dunk. Other party hangouts? For sure. But for me, a business whose literal value proposition is to uplift local bakers, local people from the local area, I never stood a chance, y'all. And many other business owners around me who are way more seasoned, who've survived for decades, were unfazed. They didn't even bother showing up to all the prep meetings, which I probably should have taken as a sign. But today, my business had the worst sales day of my entire life, including when I was a pop-up. Now, I don't know anything, but it feels like the wild, aggressive energy of sports tourism repels locals. The people who live here, who work here, who play here, like the people I thought we cared about. And sure, downtown looks nice now that we've relocated all the unhoused to Little Saigon, a place that the tourists are never going to see. Now that the streets are nice and clean, now that there's public bathrooms sprouting out everywhere easily like mushrooms, even though that's everything that all urbanists have asked for decades. Downtown becomes a thing that locals, real people who live here, want to stay as far away from as possible. I'm frustrated because today really sucked. And talking to many other business owners in the International District, it really hurt for them too. Can you imagine if I had done all the prep that everyone urged me to do? If I had hired extra people and actually prepped extra? And this is supposed to be the best match that Seattle has? Give me a break.
And he brings up an issue there that I hadn't really thought about. For these neighborhoods, kind of in the downtown vicinity, that aren't, you know, immediate attractions for World Cup fans like Soto and like downtown and Pike Place Market, you know, they're not even benefiting right now from the regular customers that they would have, the regular traffic that would be coming. Because regular people who aren't engaged in the World Cup festivities, they're not going to brave all that just to go to Chinatown. Like, they're not going to brave all that to go eat in Chinatown or shop in Chinatown or anything like that. So they're not going to come at all during the World Cup festivities. And so not only is Chinatown not getting the benefit of World Cup fans, because the city has basically directed people, oh, walk on this safe path and it'll take you right downtown to Pike Place Market. And then also we're going to shove all the homeless drug addicts. So that's just not a place that people are going to go. So they're not getting the World Cup fans. And then they're also not getting their regular traffic either. So at this time when the city promised them, oh my gosh, spend money, staff up, have all of this ready, things are going to be great, they're having their worst days of sales ever in their businesses. And as they accused the city of Seattle last week, they say it's racist. You're shoving the worst of the worst, all these bad elements into Chinatown ID. You're directing sports fans to go around the Chinatown International District, and we're all paying the price. So they're going to be out protesting today, as they should. We'll talk more about the World Cup coming up a little later. First, Seattle is going to be facing years of empty zombie towers with a 37% vacancy rate. This segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Make sure you sign up for their newsletter to be alerted to opportunities to do just that. Now, I'm going to talk about a Seattle Times article. And the whole premise of the article, you know, factually accurate, good, but it's an example of showing the disconnect that the Times has with, you know, cause and effect that we often see with articles that even have a glimpse of hope that they write. Because one of the responsibilities, I really believe, of the press is to assign blame. I think when there's a problem, the media has to assign blame. Whose fault is this? Who did this? And the Seattle Times never wants to assign blame to the true culprits, which are often the Democrats, because the Democrats control everything. So here's the headline from the Seattle Times. As downtown Seattle offices empty, city is facing years of zombie towers. So this is from Paul Roberts, the Seattle Times business reporter. Downtown Seattle may be sending strong "we're back" vibes during its World Cup star turn, but downtown's economic engine is still stuck on the sidelines. Nearly 37% now. This figure, it was like 28% last year, and we thought that was bad. 37% of the downtown Seattle office space is vacant, the most of any major U.S. downtown. Iconic office towers like the 44-floor U.S. Bank Center at Fifth Avenue and Pike Street are nearly half empty and trading at fire sale prices. Veteran developers like Martin Selig have defaulted on huge pieces of their office portfolios. The city's office economy is in free fall. Since 2020, downtown office properties have lost a staggering $15 billion, or 46% of their value, and are generating $128 million less in property taxes, according to the King County Assessor's office data. So of any major U.S. downtown in America, Seattle is the worst off. Seattle has the most vacant office spaces, and all these developers who have poured money into these buildings are writing off huge losses. It is scary stuff, and that's why they're calling them zombie, right? So here's a little bit of a glimpse at where we are compared to other places in the United States. So New York City, even the socialist-run New York City, has a 22% vacancy rate. The U.S. average is 23%. San Francisco, which is often referred to as sort of one of the, you know, most derelict cities in the nation because of how they handled homelessness and substance abuse for so long, even San Francisco is doing better than us. 31%. Los Angeles, 32%. In Seattle, 36, a little over 36, 37% of office space in downtown Seattle is vacant. And that's when you consider that. I'm glad the Seattle Times wrote this amidst the World Cup, because it speaks to something that we've been discussing, which is the World Cup is great. I'm so excited for the businesses down there. Downtown proper looks great. The homeless drug addicts are gone. But none of that is permanent. And as soon as it all pulls out, the drug addicts will come back to Third and Pike. The drug addicts will be back in SoDo, in Pioneer Square. And the office buildings will still be empty. So this is a nice little break, but it's covering up a brutal reality for the city of Seattle. Now, here's the disconnect. The Seattle Times goes on to say, some commenters have blamed the downtown office apocalypse on Seattle's taxes, anti-business rhetoric, and perceptions of public safety. Yeah, okay. It's true that Seattle is losing office tenants to more business-friendly, less frayed downtowns like Bellevue, where the 25% downtown vacancy rate is closer to the national average. The bigger culprit, though, is the tech sector. Its astonishing decade-long push for office space and equally astonishing slowdown left downtown Seattle with a gap between supply and demand that will be very difficult to bridge. So here's a disconnect. Like I said, some commenters have blamed the downtown office
apocalypse.
Commentators.
Which,
oh, some commentators like me. Some commentators have blamed the downtown office apocalypse on Seattle's taxes, anti-business rhetoric, and perceptions of public safety. And then they say the bigger culprit is the tech sector. First of all of it is important to talk about. And the reality that you just brought up in this article contradicts the whole thesis. That you say, oh, Bellevue's downtown vacancy rate is 25%, which is about the national average. So we have a difference of 11% 10 miles apart. So yeah, what's the difference between Seattle and Bellevue? Public safety, taxes, and the anti-business rhetoric and animus. Huge difference. So 11%, that's a lot. So let's not discount. And I would also note, Bellevue's vacancy rate is lower, but their cost to lease per square foot is double, if not triple. So they have a lower vacancy rate, even though it's like $60 a square foot in Bellevue in some places to get an office space. And in Seattle, you could scoop one up for $20 a square foot, maybe even less. So that's a huge difference, that businesses are willing to spend way more money, sometimes three times more money leasing an office space in Bellevue than they are in Seattle. But then he throws out this the bigger culprit, though, is the tech sector. Talks about how, wow, they bought a lot of office space, they built buildings, and now they're sort of downsizing. What is one of the number one reasons why the tech sector is downsizing? In Seattle specifically, well, it expands elsewhere. Capital gains tax. The capital gains tax combined with a new income tax on quote-unquote millionaires is sending the tech sector running. And it's not just the businesses that are here, the tech businesses that are here. We've had some of these people on the show who are moving their businesses, who are leaving. But what you always forget is the people who are never going to bring their tech business here. They're never going to bring their startup here. Because when they go to sell it, they're going to be punished with a capital gains tax. I was just with someone this weekend, a friend of a friend at a 4th of July party. He's got three businesses in the tech sector he's getting ready to sell. You know what he's not going to do? He's not going to sell them here. So he's leaving the state in a matter of months. Because when he has that big win from these businesses he's worked hard to create, he doesn't want to do it here. And so you have capital gains, and then you have the income tax on millionaires. And that's a huge reason why people are leaving and not going to come. But we want to sort of have this amorphous, oh, tech sector is retracting. And I understand there's a lot going on with AI and the like and all of that stuff. But there are other places, Austin, Memphis, Miami, that are seeing burgeoning tech sectors, that are seeing tech companies come there on a daily basis. So yeah, let's not act like it's just some, oh, you know, AI is a big thing. No, Seattle's the worst downtown in the nation when it comes to vacancy rates. And we have a huge part of that in the tech sector. And you want to not blame who's to blame. It's the Democrats. It's Bob Ferguson. It's former Governor Jay Inslee. It's Senator Jamie Peterson. It's all these people who pushed these policies that have made this a very bad place to start a business and a very bad place to keep a business. And that little sentence that they mentioned in their article is why even Democrats and progressives should care. Where he says that since 2020, downtown properties have lost a staggering $15 billion or 46% of their value. What happens when they lose 46% of their value? They are generating $128 million less in property taxes. That's it. If you care for no other reason, for the Seattle socialist progressives who want to use all this money from big bad businesses to fund their wish list of items, well, that money is going away. And you either won't have any money to fund those things, or you'll have to go crawling back to the middle class and the poor to tax them more. So that's why everybody should care. That segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Make sure you sign up for their newsletter to be alerted to opportunities to do just that. All right, we've seen some teachers' union dues go to dumb stuff. This might take the cake. We'll discuss first. Our friend Zach Abraham at Bulwark Capital is having another one of his free live webinars coming up July 23rd, 3:30 p.m. Pacific time. Could the market's biggest blind spots put your retirement at risk? Investors and advisors are focused on AI, inflation, conflicting headlines. But what if the real risk to your portfolio is something the market isn't seeing? Join Bulwark Capital Zach Abraham for his free market blind spot webinar. It's happening again July 23rd, 3:30 p.m. Pacific time. You can get your questions answered by Zach and his team. It's totally free to sign up. Register at knowyourriskpodcast.com. That's knowyourriskpodcast.com. While you're there, you can subscribe to Zach's daily podcast, find out how to follow him on YouTube, X, all the things, knowyourriskpodcast.com. All right, let's get to our segment, Unbelievable. All right, the most evil force in Washington politics is the Washington Education Association. So, makes sense that one of the most evil, destructive forces in national politics is the National Education Association. They had their 105th representative assembly in Denver. I think it's still going on now. And this is where they basically just, similar to a political party, the union, the National Education Association, it's going to, you know, come up with what is our platform as a national teachers union? What are some action items of things that we're going to try to pursue? What are some political issues that we want to get involved in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This will underscore why I always say, opt out today, opt out of the teachers union. If you are a semi-sane person, as I talk to you about some of these new business items for the National Education Association, I really want you to ask yourself whether this is something that you want union dues going towards. So, business item number 10. The National Education Association will call for the impeachment, conviction, and removal of Donald Trump from the U.S. presidency. We, the NEA, will call for a national march on Washington, D.C. to remove Trump before the November 2026 midterm elections and call on unions and other progressive organizations to join us in taking action to protect democracy and defend public education. Now, you might be thinking, OK, well, they're going to have a march and they're going to want Trump removed from office. It's not just that. They had a cost implication assigned to this. This item cannot be accomplished with current staff and resources under our proposed budget. So it would cost an additional $5,236,193. You guys, and credit to our friend Corey DeAngelis for uncovering all this stuff. They want to spend. Trump's got 2.5 years left in office, okay? About 2.5 years left in office. The National Education Association wants to spend more than $5 million on a campaign to try to get him impeached and convicted of some sort of crime, as if they haven't tried all of that before. More than $5 million of dues from teachers across the country they want to spend on virtue signaling to try to get President Donald Trump out of office before the 2026 midterms. That's what they're focused on. Nothing to do with bettering the education of kids. $5 million to try to get Donald Trump out of office. All right, let's see. New business item number 47. They also want to have the Health and Human Services Secretary, RFK Jr., and the Education Secretary, Linda McMahon, removed from office. Oh, God, how much is that one going to cost? They didn't put a price tag on this one. No price tag? It says the NEA declares a vote of no confidence in the current United States Secretary of Education and current United States Secretary of Health and Human Services due to actions and policies that have demonstrated gross negligence. Well, their issue with Linda McMahon is she's for school choice, and the NEA can't have someone who's for school choice because then parents and families and kids wouldn't be trapped in a failing public education system. Here's a great one. New business item number 24. The NEA president will write a letter to the United States Congressional Black Caucus introducing NEA resolutions 1I62 educational reparations and discuss the enormous impact it would have on Black and African Americans. If educational reparations were passed, it would immediately reduce student loan debt, create equitable funding for HBCUs, and support African American Black students in special education programs. In addition, it would eliminate property tax-based education funding models. Yeah, so they want education reparations to reduce student loan debt for Black students and eliminate property tax-based education funding. Yes, that's not racist at all. Just saying, if you're Black, no more student loans for you. Totally not racist. So they're also spending your dues pushing racist ideas. Let's see. We can't let this go without something on trans. New business item 78. Push stories of trans kids who run away from red states. It says the NEA shall publish on the NEA website Erin in the Morning, National Legal Risk Assessment Map for Transgender Adults and Youth. So it says they're going to write an article to be published online about the systemic erasure of access for transgender people across multiple states, highlighting transgender youth who have been forced to leave their states or hide their identity. So they're basically going to put out propaganda about, you know, transgender kids and how they're not safe in red states. And they're going to spend $12,500 to do it. Okay. One other thing that happened with the new president of the NEA, Becky Pringle, is, and this is so telling to me, just absolutely telling. So she's up on stage, new president of the National Education Association. And what is one of the things that she took time to celebrate while she was up on stage?
And Washington State! Outrage by the unfair and unjust tax system educators fought to put a millionaire's tax into law.
Yay! Literally, she's admitting that it was the teachers' union that controlled the Democrats, that got the income tax on quote-unquote millionaires. And it is. And it is. Teachers Union and the SEIU. I have this public records request I'm working on, and I requested from legislators in Olympia the number of emails, all the email communications they've had with SEIU. And I just got back a kind of estimate that said there's 17,000 responsive documents. 17,000 for a period of a year and a half. A year and a half. The unions control Olympia. It's not the Democrats, it's the unions. And she's admitting it. Oh, educators wanted to tax rich people, and so they got it done in Washington State. Opt out today. What is the website? It's optouttoday.com or .org? Optouttoday.com. Yep. Opt out today. No, that's not it. It's dot. Oh, it is .com. Optouttoday.com. Optouttoday.com. There is no downside. There are organizations that will step up on your behalf and fill any sort of gaps that you might lose by leaving the teachers union. Why do you want your money being spent on trying to impeach Donald Trump? Why do you want your money being spent on trying to trans kids in schools? Why do you want your money being spent on trying to keep boys and girls sports in Washington State? The WEA and the NEA have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on the campaign to oppose the initiatives to restore parental rights and to protect girls' sports. There is no excuse anymore. We meet teachers occasionally who'll say, I know, I'm still a member of the union. Not today. Optouttoday.com, opt out of the union, or at least start the process to figure out what it would mean for you and whether the resources are there to help you out for all the things that the union might actually do for you. It's outrageous. There's no reason for any sane person to be a member of the union. I cannot even understate how much would change in this state and in this country if sane teachers just decided we're not doing the union thing anymore. It would be immensely good. All right, coming up next, we'll get into the FIFA drama with Trump and the red card and all of that stuff. I'm not a soccer expert. Can I just say that at the beginning? I don't understand the first thing about soccer, but I do know politics, so we'll discuss. First, if you're a small to mid-sized landlord in the state of Washington, consider becoming a member of the Rental Housing Association of Washington. The RHA does a lot of different things. They have events that happen all year long on housing policy. I've been to a few of them. I've spoken at a few of them. It's a good time. They can also help you on an individual basis as a landlord with screening, forms, keeping up to date on rules and regulations. And then they've got your back down in Olympia. They are down there advocating for good housing policy, advocating and pushing back against bad housing policy. And they have some property rights lawsuits they've also pursued to try to protect your private property rights. RHAWA.org, RHAWA.org. It's about $260 a year to become a member. If you're a landlord and you have one unit or 10 units, doesn't matter. You should be a member of RHA, RHAWA.org. All right. And first of all, really exciting that Team USA is back in Seattle. I think it's going to be an absolutely insane day in Seattle for sure. But there's a little bit of a controversy afoot. I don't know, it might be completely manufactured. So as you probably heard, one of our star players, Fallerin Balogun, is now going to be able to play. Nicole, you looked at me like I pronounced that right.
Wow, you went right through it. I thought you were going to hesitate a little.
I don't like when talking heads all of a sudden pretend to be an expert on things. Because it's out, you know, whatever it is, like, oh, you know, today I'm an expert on Iran. Tomorrow I'm an expert on constitutional law. Mm-hmm.
I don't know jack about soccer, but I did watch the game where he got a red card. And as a casual observer, I was like, well, that seems silly. Like, he just kind of accidentally stepped on the guy. It seemed like they were both going for the ball. Right. The guy's on the other team, his foot, you know, little ankle rolled. So they gave him a red card, and I learned a lot about a red card. It means you got to leave the game. They can't even replace you
right.
for the whole match, and then you can't play in the next match.
I didn't realize that either.
I was like, that's a little intense. Right. And so as a casual fan, I was like, that seems outrageous. But Balogun took it really well. He was very, very nice about it, didn't scream, didn't throw a fit or whatever it was. But I would say, like, most soccer experts that I was watching online said the red card seemed a little bit intense. So FIFA reviewed it, and apparently it's part of the rules that they can suspend the punishment. So they said, oh, now he can play in the game today. So apparently then it comes out, and Trump responds to this on Truth Social. He's like, this is the right decision. And then it comes out that Trump had actually called the head of FIFA to express his displeasure with the red card. This is the New York Times. Trump asked FIFA to review U.S. players' suspension. Now he's eligible to play. The reversal of Fowler and Balogun's World Cup suspension is highly unusual. It was the first time since 1962 that FIFA has nullified a suspension for a red card received during the World Cup. But then I was also reading that apparently Cristiano Ronaldo, in the qualifiers, he got a red card and they suspended part of his punishment. Like, he was supposed to be suspended for 3 games, and I think they suspended like 2 of those, and he couldn't play in one, but he could play in the other 2. But I guess they're parsing this to say during the World Cup, because I think the Ronaldo one was 2025. So there is some precedent there. So here's President Trump talking about his conversation with FIFA, I guess.
I asked for a review because I didn't think it was a foul. And, you know, again, I'm good at this stuff. I didn't think it was a foul. I thought it was 2 great athletes that crashed into each other and got entangled. That was not a guy punching somebody in the face or anything that, you know, would be different. I think it would have really stained this incredible champion. We got to have our best players, and Belgium's got a great team, by the way. We got to have our best players, and they have to have their best. And if we win or we lose, it's fair. The referee's decision to red card. I didn't know what the hell a red card was. When I found out, I said, you got to be kidding. This guy just hands up. Okay, your best player is not going to play next week or in the next game. I said, wow, that's a lot of power. That's terrible. But then I looked at his past, and it wasn't so great.
So anyway, Trump gets involved, and FIFA's saying, look, the president calling had nothing to do. It was an independent review. There's a rule for this for a reason. So they're insisting, FIFA's insisting the president's call had nothing to do with it. But of course, because it now involves Trump, oh my gosh, now people are losing their minds. Because Trump said, this was an injustice. It would have stained the World Cup if this had been allowed to stand. But now the lefties and Belgium for sure are saying, oh, well, now Trump has tainted the World Cup by demanding special treatment for America's star player. There's all these memes going around. The right loves it, the left hates it. These memes were actually hilarious. It's like, he gets the red card, and then Balogun hits him with the Trump card. I liked the Trump with the reverse Uno card. I thought that was equally funny. So the right loves it. They're like, Trump's a hero, and the left hates it, because now they're like, oh, now even if the USA wins, they'll be tainted by this special treatment they got from President Trump. And I'm just like, people.
Hey,
look,
I feel like there's a lot of lefty soccer fans that should be thanking Trump.
Well, but the truth is, at the center of it, is that FIFA says Trump had nothing to his call well, didn't influence it.
Whether he did or didn't, I don't know.
Right. So I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll, do you think President Trump overstepped by contacting FIFA about the red card? Yes or no? Nicole?
Nah. He might have bragged a little too much about it, because then it draws extra attention. But I think it's okay to call and be like, what are you thinking? We're the hosts. What are you thinking? That was ridiculous.
I'm going to say yes, only because
it caused this.
Only
stir.
Because now, like, all this excitement about Team USA, people are going to just blame Trump. And that bothers me. And I was like, I wish he'd be more self-aware that, hey, if I do this and I talk about it, half the country is going to and the world is going to lose their ever-loving minds about it. But I don't know.
Half the world. I think just one little country.
Sure. So 51%, this is a very close poll, very close. 51% of you say yes, you think the president overstepped. And keep in mind, our viewership definitely leans conservative. Mm-hmm. 51% say he overstepped, 49% say no, he didn't. Matt Gilbert, hell no. The president is standing up for America. What's the point of being the most powerful man in the world if you can't make a call to see what's up?
And I mean, do you think that, you know, a representative from a different country, if it had happened to Belgium, that they wouldn't call and be like, hey, have you reviewed that?
Yeah. Well, like, and then Belgium said they're lawyering up.
They would do it too.
Yeah, I don't know. But Trump has a special relationship with FIFA. They gave him that FIFA Peace Prize and all this stuff. Nicole, you're looking on your face right now.
Hey, I guess it's who you know.
Ren says, I'm torn. I don't think he should have, but FIFA is known to be corrupt. The red card should never have been given in the first place. So who knows if they would have actually reviewed the incident. And that is the thing that most people seem to agree, the red card was totally out of bounds. But then it gets taken away and then they lose their minds. It's like you said, you thought the red card was out of bounds. Richard says, he only asked that the call be reviewed. The decision was up to FIFA, not the president of FIFA, whom the president spoke to. As a past CEO, it is typical for executives to discuss issues. Relax, people. Take a breath.
Yeah, he just asked for the review.
Yes.
That's all.
I'll review it. Robert says, I don't follow sports, but I chose yes, because without knowing details, it seems like an odd move. Vic said no. He just has a better contact list than me.
Good network.
Yeah, it is who you know. Mm-hmm. Diana said yes. Several of the expert commentators said the call was bogus. And yes, there's a process in place for FIFA to evaluate and overrule poor calls. But Trump should have stayed out of this. It will undermine the U.S. team's win. And that's sort of what I kind of agree with Diana. I feel like it's just a political talking point that didn't need to exist.
Like he said, he's good at it.
He's good at it, yes. But honestly, Belgium, suck it up. If you really, like, America wants to play against people at their best. Like, I think American fans, like, if Belgium's main player was down, American fans would be like, ah, shoot, you know, we want to play him at their best. Don't you think?
Yeah, I agree.
Belgium's like, no, we want that guy sidelined. It's like, you wusses. That's why America's the greatest country on earth that ever existed.
Agreed.
All right. On the protest planned over Erica Kirk. So disgusting.
Stupid.
Like, you losers.
They are. They're just losers. Whiny losers.
Whiny baby losers. Necro Two Shoes. I thought the lefties hated AI data centers, yet here they are doing AI posters. Yeah.
Well, it wasn't even very good.
It wasn't even very good. I don't even know if they used AI or they used Photoshop.
The horns were like off center.
Here. It's like, can you just move it over a little bit? All right.
From Diane, I'm not familiar with this Patriot group. What is the detestable about reclaiming America?
Well, I think if you're trying to reclaim it for the whites, then it's probably detestable. Yeah. And to be clear, I'm not uber familiar besides their, what is the word I was looking for? What do you call those pants?
Well, they're slacks or.
No, that color.
Khakis?
Khakis.
Yeah.
Can you think of anything like less scary than khakis and a blue polo tucked in? Chris Parker, left-wing political movements to include physical confrontations are endorsed, supported, and protected by Democrat politicians, the media, and legal groups. Right. You could look at two far fringe movements. One is violent, one's nonviolent. And they're angrier about the nonviolent one than they are about actual physical violent and threats. It's crazy.
If you have to cover your face...
Yeah, if you have to cover your face, you're probably doing
something wrong.
And that goes for Patriot Front as well. If you're out there and you have to wear a mask to do what you do, like, that means you're concerned about what people will think of you, right? Man up, you know, if you really believe
afraid of
it,
losing
man
your job,
up, right?
Of what, yeah.
On socialism in America.
Oh, my turn.
Yeah.
From Alice, socialist policy has become more popular because America has cast the safety net too wide. The younger generations have suffered much hardship.
Have never suffered much hardship,
but they have not figured out that free just means I pay instead of them.
Yeah.
For sure. I think that this is the first generation that has known little to no hardship at all, especially when it comes to like wars. Wars are very distant to us over here until it affects our gas prices and then we're all upset about it. But in reality, every other generation before us has fought hard for what we have over here.
Yeah. And against, socialism. David Prince, $10 super chat. Do you generally consider it to be acceptable for a person to be happy about the death of a public figure they oppose? He's talking about a poll that said very liberal people said 24% of them said it was acceptable to be happy if someone you oppose dies. Conservatives, 3%. This is a YouGov poll.
Right.
And this is an old one, but not too old, but very people who are very conservative, only 3% said it's acceptable to be happy about the death of someone you opposed politically. 24% of people who said very liberal said one fourth. It's absolutely insane. Country guy on socialism in America. Responsibly steward your private property means that you should rent at rates that will make you have a loss. Why does he think that people will like that idea? I'm talking about Zohran Mamdani's communist idea to take over the properties of landlords he doesn't think are good landlords.
From Average Joe, LOL, plenty of examples. Pardon me while I sprint away with my non-answer.
Yeah, the Jayapal running away from the reporter who said, can you give me an example of socialism that's worked out well?
There's policies like, that have been helpful.
Miso okay, Corny said only modern day socialist countries that work would be only modern day socialist countries that work, be it Sweden or Norway, strict borders and small countries and very few people of color. I don't know about that, but I don't know the makeup of Sweden or Norway. All right.
On World Cup protesting, Country Guy says, is there anything more racist than moving homeless and drug addicts to Chinatown ID? The message is that your home and business is the place to move. The trash.
Yep. And they do it in Portland as well. All the drug addicts in Chinatown. PO4, if Seattle leaders are talking, they're lying. It's just that simple. Yeah, I agree.
On Seattle faces years of zombie towers, Tyrone Wilson says, give the homeless the buildings.
Yeah, that would be the right thing to do, right? Take them away. That's what probably Katie Wilson will do. She'll just take them from the private property owners. She'll seize them. Communism, and then give them to the homeless, and then they'll burn down. A couple of super chats. Old Sub Sailor, just to say it again, if President Trump's domestic policy wasn't so weak, we might not be dealing with the dramatic surge in socialism and communism. They control the unions, mainstream media, and the public education system.
I was going to say, I don't think
his domestic policy is weak, but yeah, we're not big into unions or public education, and the media has been controlled by the Democrats for a long time.
I did get a message from a teacher who talked to her HR representative about opting out of the union and got guilted into staying.
And that tomorrow.
Well, apparently that HR person is no longer there, but she just said the pressure is tough to fight in schools 100%. Because her HR representative told her that they wouldn't be able to fund anything then.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're putting all this pressure blame on the teachers if they try to leave. So optouttoday.com.
Diana Manning also wanted an update on Chuck. I don't have an update on our friend Chuck. I don't know where he went.
It's a mystery.
It's a mystery. It's bumming me out.
It is.
All right, Nicole, thank you. We'll get to our closing sanity check coming up momentarily. First, if you are trying to save some money as a family, maybe budget's getting tight with the cost of gas and inflation, reach out to our friends at First Mark Insurance and see if they can't save you a little bit of money to make up the difference on your insurance costs. And I mean, that's the case for so many Undivided viewers and listeners who are saving like $100 a month, which adds up $1,200 a year. That can help you cover some of these increased costs. Mike and I got our renewal notice from them, and it's always like you hold your breath and they're like, oh, we could save you $2,000. I was like, what? When does this happen? Who does that? It was just amazing. So firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. The very best part is they're working for you, not the insurance companies. So they're going to do what's best for you. That might even mean turning away your business and saying, we can't save you any money. Stick with the insurance you already have. So the sign of an honest company. And when you need them and when you call them, they're picking up the phone and it's going to be a local person right here in Washington State who can talk to you when something happens or you need to use one of your policies. So firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. They work for you, not the insurance companies. All right, with that, let's get to our closing sanity check. Alicia Keys. Oh my gosh, this is so exciting. So exciting. We now have a major pop star. Pop star? R&B? Yeah. What is pop star? We now have a major pop star who is speaking out about women's rights and the need to protect girls' sports and spaces. Alicia Keys.
Did you know that it's been 100 years since the Equal Rights Amendment was first introduced? And now, still, women don't have an explicit guarantee to equal rights under the U.S. Constitution. Can you believe that? I couldn't even believe that was real.
Yeah, just kidding. She's not talking about girls' sports. I honestly don't even know what she's talking about. She says women don't have the same rights as men. I mean, is it really because, like, oh, all men are created equal? Do they want all persons are created equal put in there? What do they want?
Name I'm not sure. One, they want a lot of amendments to the Constitution.
Name one constitutional protection a man has that you do not have as a woman. Anybody? Alicia? The only one I can think of right now that's not a constitutional right, but Title IX is boys and girls sports, so I have to assume mm-hmm. she's talking about protecting girls sports. You so I'm think. Just going to say that Alicia Keys is now on Team Sanity when it comes to protecting girls sports. But just so we can share with you what she's talking about, there's this weird website that she's pushing to called People's Bill of Rights. Not red, not blue, just you. Why do I not believe that? Why do I think it is very much blue, about a blue movement, where they're talking about working together to form new changes to the U.S. Constitution? Look, if you want to put in a constitutional amendment that says boys aren't girls, I'll be involved in that.
They really,
for sure.
They really push that you can do it from your couch.
You can do it from your couch. That's what you need that's what you need to get the young kids involved. You can do it from your couch. All right, that has been our closing sanity check. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. If you'd like to support our show, we rely on subscribers to keep the show going. Go to undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com. It's $5 a month. We've never adjusted it for inflation. UndividedPod.com. Click on the banner that says support the show. Nicole has this look on her face
maybe we should.
Maybe we should. Maybe it's time. Oh,
stop making promises, Brandy.
I just said we never have. But not that we never
I think
will.
You have said we won't.
I don't think I've said
we could
that.
Do it for other reasons.
I have no plans to. I've got no plans to.
Blame Trump's war.
No, I'm not going to blame Trump. All right. We'll see you tomorrow.